Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
Adam, on our show today, we'll be talking with Dr. Rachel Friedman, assistant professor at Harvard Medical School and medical oncologist at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, about talking to patients about cancer. She's a breast cancer specialist and has some interesting research about the topic.
Yeah, I think that anyone, and we've had so many patients, Christy, you and I, that when they're diagnosed with cancer, we hear back, you know, I don't remember anything from that first appointment. Yet it seems like it's so critical, that appointment and all the appointments. And so I think we'll all learn both how to maybe talk to patients with cancer better, but also how to listen and what can we learn.
Well, first, we have some research that matters. We're going to talk about loneliness and how long you live.
And we're going to be talking about it because there's new research. And second, about exercise as we're aging. What's the mechanism?
And about brain power and how it peaks in different ways as people age.
And then finally, are we over-treating maybe a whole group of patients with low-risk atrial fibrillation?
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Okay. So we know that obesity shortens life. Obesity. We've talked about that a lot.
And smoking shortens life.
Yes, lots of things.
And then we had a recent guest that talked about the plague of loneliness, and we
That's
talked
right.
about that. But here, this research suggests that this plague of loneliness really is indeed a plague that is as deadly as obesity or smoking cigarettes.
That's right. So this was research from Brigham Young University, where they looked at more than 3 million participants from studies looking at data for loneliness, social isolation, and living alone, and looking at different variables to see what kind of risk that has on how long someone lives.
And they said they, you know, controlled for, try to figure out, you know, does, you know, how old someone is, what whether male or female, what other types of health conditions they had. And they found that for every lack of social connection one has with others, there's additional risk, and this was published in the journal Perspectives on Psychological Science.
And they also found the existence of relationships with other people provides a positive health effect. And so, I mean, this ties into something we were talking about recently about having friends and how many friends and social networks should you have, not just friends on Facebook, but actually people that you are connected to.
And I like the way they talk about some experiences being superficial. Now, who are we to say what's superficial? But we do know that it's a difference between an email, a text, a tweet, and a real conversation, and, you know, a telephone conversation with people. And I think this connection, the more connected it is, the stronger the social bond, and perhaps the less tie with loneliness.
Well, and it tells us to ask these questions of our patients. And really, as we try to do as family doctors, know our patients and pay attention to people who are lonely.
And we probably have to change the whole medical paradigm. We're going to have to start teaching this to our residents.
Mm-hmm.
We have to start teaching this to medical students. And I think our patients, our listeners, can help all of us better understand how to have these conversations. Important.
So let's talk about exercise and motor skills in seniors. Now, we've known and we've talked many times on the show, Adam, that there is this association between physical activity and motor functions as people age in older adults.
And we also know that there are these changes that happen in the brain in these white spots that are called white matter hyperintensities. And we find more of these types of spots when people who are older and have difficulty walking.
So this was a study where they looked at 167 people ages 60 to 96 years old who did not have dementia. And they wore activity monitors for 11 days, and they got all these MRI brain imaging tests, and also had like motor performance tests, grip strength, finger tapping, all these little body strength and agility tests to see what they found.
And they found that, I mean, patients who were more active tended to have better motor function, which is kind of what we would expect, but it weren't necessarily related to these white matter hyperintensities, suggesting that, you know what, maybe these white matter hyperintensities aren't the only story.
Right. So if you had a bunch of these white matter spots in your brain, if you didn't exercise very much, those spots were linked with poor motor function. But for the people who exercised a lot, even if they had a bunch of those white spots in their brain, they still had great motor function. So there was some sort of protective effect about the physical activity on the effect of those white spots. It's confusing, but it's just to say that exercise is a good thing.
And it didn't necessarily be like the extremes of exercise, because at those extremes, there wasn't actually added benefit. There's probably some minimal threshold that you can get some benefit from. And that's really good news, I think, for all of our patients and all of us as we're getting older.
So also talking about getting older.
Speak for yourself.
Well, speak for both of us. We are getting older every day. But how well do our brains work as we get older? Most people think, oh, it just declines and declines and declines. And yet, this is a study kind of looking at almost 50,000 people trying to sort out what the strengths are of people at different parts of their life.
And these 50,000 people took online tests on the website Games with Words and testmybrain.org. You ever play Games with Words?
I play Words with Friends and Scramble, but not
close
Games
enough,
with Words.
Close enough. It would suggest, this research, that you were better peaking with your short-term memory when you were younger.
I believe that.
But your emotional state is actually probably at its maturity.
I know. It said that people in their 40s and 50s do a better job of translating emotional signals from other people, and that seniors have more overall knowledge. Now, that makes sense. They've lived longer. They've had more experience. They have more overall knowledge than we have or compared with younger people.
And this research actually is in the journal Psychological Science. And I think a take-home message is that, you know, at every age, the great writers of history would know that there are really valuable contributions.
Mm-hmm.
And the contributions of someone in their 20s is not necessarily the same. And it shouldn't be the same. And I think for a great team, I would look for people of different ages, because they can
right.
all contribute something. At least this research would suggest, with their brain power.
Great point. Okay. We're going to talk about blood thinners and this thing called atrial fibrillation. We've talked about it a bunch of times on the show. And atrial fibrillation is that sort of irregular heartbeat that can cause blood clots in the heart and lead to a stroke. And blood thinners are given for some patients to reduce that risk of stroke.
And because so many patients get the blood thinners, it's easy to forget sometimes that research came out a number of years ago that said not every patient does need these blood thinners, at least the ones that you have to be monitored more regularly compared to just a baby aspirin. And so this was research looking at how many people in the United States might be getting these more risky blood thinners rather than just an aspirin. And this was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association subspecialty journal, Internal Medicine.
And they looked at 11,000 patients who are younger than 60 at low risk of stroke, and found that about 25% of these patients were prescribed blood thinners, which is contrary to current treatment guidelines. So people who aren't at high risk, and who actually it's been determined that it's more dangerous to give them the blood thinners for risk of bleeding than it is to prevent stroke, 25% of them were prescribed this, perhaps overprescribed.
And these were more likely to be men, people who were older and overweight. But all of these men, overweight and older, were all at low risk. That's the key point. So talk mm-hmm. to your doctor if you have atrial fibrillation, have a loved one, to find out, are you at higher risk or not?
I'll also say it's a shame that we tend to overtreat these people who are at low risk. And then as people get older, doctors tend to not give blood thinners because they're worried people fall for a variety of reasons. But those are the patients, the oldest patients, who benefit the most from the blood thinners in many cases. So do talk to your doctor about the pros and cons.
That'll conclude the Research Matters portions of our show. We'll take a short break. And when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Rachel Friedman, assistant professor at Harvard Medical School and oncologist, about talking to patients about cancer. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. A presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, We're talking with Dr. Rachel Friedman, assistant professor at Harvard Medical School and medical oncologist at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, about talking to patients about cancer.
Thanks for being with us, Dr. Friedman.
Thank you so much for having me, Adam and Christy. It's a pleasure to be here today.
Well, great. Well, we love to hear people's stories. What is it that drew you to be excited about oncology and the field of oncology and cancer?
Well, my story is one of somewhat taking advantage of opportunities as they present themselves to me. Although I grew up as a little girl, accompanying my father to rounds at the hospital and became engaged in the idea of becoming a physician early on, I really had no idea that I was going to end up being an oncologist and a breast cancer specialist at all. In fact, I thought I was going to end up in pediatrics. And as I moved through my training, like most of us, once we're exposed to various things, we see what sticks, we see what we like, we see what we connect with. And over time, I really found myself enjoying women's health and women's health issues and sort of presented myself in a place where I had to make a decision whether I was going to actually do pediatrics or internal medicine and ended up going into internal medicine. And then from there, really enjoyed my oncology rotations. While others were sometimes transferring away or trading them away, I was sort of getting more and more of them as much as I could, and ended up really falling into a wonderful mentorship and training experience here at Dana-Farber, where I landed myself in the breast cancer group here and have stayed there ever since.
You know, when patients come in and they hear the diagnosis of cancer, and we think about talking to patients about cancer, how do you think that conversation, what are the expectations that you think patients have when they come into that first meeting, and what you as an oncologist or even a primary care doctor might have? Are they the same or are they different?
I think they're different. I think that, you know, patients come to us absolutely terrified, and I'm usually meeting patients very soon after they've received a cancer diagnosis, and most of the time I've seen that I'm meeting a patient, they've already received a diagnosis, but they haven't really gotten any additional information. So, for example, you know, a lot of our patients have their cancers detected by either feeling a mass themselves or having something abnormal found on a mammogram, which leads to a biopsy, and then their provider, you know, their primary care provider or family practitioner calls them and says, you have a cancer, I'm going to get you set up with a team. And then that's sort of it. Patients really don't get a lot of information. So we work very hard at Dana-Farber to actually get patients in very quickly, because I know that that time, and we know that that time can be so anxiety-provoking for patients. And, you know, when I'm first meeting somebody, I really take a long time to go through what a breast is, what is a breast made of, what are the structures in the breast, how does a normal breast work, what is its function, before I sort of take them into what a cancer is. I mean, most patients really have no idea what cancer is. They've all heard the word. They all are scared to death of hearing that they ever would have a cancer diagnosis, but most of them don't really know what it means. So I spend some time explaining that it's uncontrolled growth of cells in the body, that cancer cells have the potential to spread, and the earlier that we find them, the better. And with breast cancer, you know, subtype really matters a lot. So I spend a lot of time going through a patient's biopsy with regard to receptors like estrogen receptor and something called HER2 receptor, which help us subtype of breast cancer and understand what treatments might be available to them. And then I really spend some time taking them through the sort of surgical options, which also is being done by a surgeon in conjunction with their visit with me. And then giving sort of an overview or a preview of some of the treatments that we might consider, mostly after surgery, although in some cases we're giving treatments before a surgery. So that initial visit is really kind of like an overview, and we really try to take our time because patients do get so overwhelmed by all the information.
When you think about that process and the fact that you've noticed so many patients come to you without knowing really what is cancer or just understanding very little about their diagnosis, how much of that should be done by the primary care doctor? How much of that do you think is being done, but maybe the patient's not ready for it, or they're so overwhelmed with the word cancer that maybe they don't remember it, or how much is even appropriate to say versus having some time to let it sort of sink in and process before you give all that other information?
It's a great question. I think that it's probably mixed what happens, you know, out there. I think some of it depends on the connection somebody has with their family practitioner or primary care provider. I think somebody who's been taken care of by the same person for a decade or more and has a very close relationship is probably going to get a little bit more than somebody who, you know, doesn't know their primary care provider very well. I think some patients don't ask a lot of questions in the beginning because they're so shell-shocked and they just want to get to that appointment and get the information. I come into the appointment saying, you know, I assume that you don't know very much. If you do, I'm happy to, you can speed me along. But my approach is really the same in everybody because I think it's totally variable what patients have heard. And also, of course, you know, we battle with people going online and searching every single thing possible before they come in. And some of them get totally overwhelmed by that. Some of them feel empowered by it because they feel like they've gotten some information. But in breast cancer in particular, that online sort of information source can be totally overwhelming because of the different subtypes and the stages and patients trying to understand what treatments are actually relevant for them.
So you had,
it really differs.
So you had did some research on this particular topic, really kind of studying cancer patients and kind of what they know about their diagnosis. It's not necessarily what they were told, because you say you're going into a comprehensive talking, but you kind of have some results. Tell us about that study, if you could, and what you found. And I guess for myself as a provider, it may not be surprising because I hear all the time from patients after they come back from their first appointment with an oncologist, I didn't remember anything. So
right.
Tell us what you found.
Sure. So, you know, I have noticed this in my practice, and I think that's why I try to be comprehensive in my initial visits to try to go over all this, because I do think it's variable and from practitioner to practitioner. And I've been really interested in how knowledge may impact somebody's receipt of treatments in breast cancer care, as well as their sort of long-term outcome and long-term adherence. Some of our treatments do go on and on for years. And I've gotten the sense that patients know very little, and I know I spend time doing it. So, you know, I think that there could be issues on both ends, that providers aren't saying it, or they're not saying enough, or no, they're not saying it in the right way that can be understood. And then there's the other side of it, which is that a patient can't hear it, can't understand it, doesn't remember it. So I think that there's multiple things that can be going on that lead to potentially poor knowledge about one's cancer. And there's been some work in the literature looking at patients with breast cancer and how well they understand treatments. And there's been a lot of focus on understanding that mastectomy is equivalent to having a lumpectomy for long-term survival. And there have been lots of sort of studies looking at sort of general rationales for treatments and whether or not patients understand that. But there's really been nothing in the literature that asks patients about their own disease and whether they understand what kind of cancer they have and what their particular characteristics are. So we surveyed, as part of a big project, 500 women who reside in California and are part of the Cancer Registry in California. And these women agreed to be surveyed about their breast cancer, and these were telephone interviews that we conducted in Spanish and in English. And we asked people in the survey questions about their breast cancers, and these things included, do you know what your estrogen receptor status is? Do you know what your stage is? Do you know what your HER2 status is? And we tried to spell these things out in questions as sort of carefully as we could so that people would understand what we were asking. And what we found is that women with breast cancer knew very little about their own cancers. And, you know, about half of patients said they knew their estrogen receptor status. About a third said they knew their HER2 status. And, you know, a little bit more women said that they knew that they knew their cancer stage. About 80% of women said they knew their cancer stage. But what we also did as part of this project was, in addition to just asking women, do you know these characteristics, we also checked if their answers were correct using registry information. And actually, even when women thought they knew the answer, for instance, for stage, 82% of women said, I know my cancer stage. But when you really looked at whether or not it was matching the registry information, it was really about half of women actually have the correct stage.
Wow.
And, you know, we don't know the implications of all of this. You know, I'm really interested in how this is all associated with receipt of treatment, and I'm now doing further work looking at that. But my hypothesis is that if people knew their stage or if they knew their HER2 status, maybe they'd be more willing, or if they could understand, to sort of take the treatment and stick with it. Because some of our treatments do take a long time.
Well, that's exactly what we're hoping to come back and talk a little bit about, these implications. Like, should everyone know this? How will that impact their treatment and their life? What about people who maybe don't want all that information? And is that their right and privilege to decide how much they want to know? All of these questions just raises more questions. So we are excited to be talking with you. We do need to take a short break. But when we come back, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Rachel Friedman, assistant professor at Harvard Medical School and medical oncologist at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, about talking to patients about cancer. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Rachel Friedman, assistant professor at Harvard Medical School and medical oncologist at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, about talking to patients about cancer. And Dr. Friedman, right before the break, you shared with us the results of an important research study that you just published that showed really that so few of your oncology patients in the study in California really knew things that are important from perhaps a treatment perspective, and your hope that by them knowing this, they might have better outcomes. But let me just ask a question that would seem implicit, is that the diagnoses and the staging of these things are really designed to communicate among doctors. They're not necessarily designed to communicate to patients, are they? Because if they were, wouldn't we choose all different types of ways of talking about it that would be much easier and simpler for them to understand and remember?
Yeah, that's a great question, Adam. I think you're right. I mean, these are medical terms and we use them to figure out what treatments are going to help somebody. But I do think that we can do better at explaining what these things mean and how they help us figure out treatments that somebody will benefit from for the cancer.
And so how, as you're looking forward, you said you're examining the question of whether or not someone's knowledge then impacts the decisions that they make. And you're having to factor in their health literacy, their own, you know, understanding of their body, their own understanding of health and their values. How do you factor all that in to really examine that?
Well, it's really difficult because you're right. Every patient's different. I mean, some patients don't want to know these things, and that's okay too. Not everybody needs to know every single detail about their cancer. But I'm worried about the patient who, you know, doesn't understand her disease, doesn't understand why treatment is being recommended, and that knowledge may actually be important to help her continue through treatment or understand why it's so important to continue that treatment. So I think that, you know, this kind of information may not be necessary for all people, but I think that we should have it in mind and offer that information to people or bring it up when we think it can be important in particular.
And have you found that to be common where people maybe stop treatment early, perhaps because they don't understand the importance or the treatment plan of how long they need to follow through?
I do think this happens sometimes. You know, I have women in particular who take hormonal therapies like tamoxifen or drugs like letrozole and anastrozole. These treatments are pills that can go on for 5 to even 10 years. And I have women who very early on don't feel great on these medications. A lot of women do feel great, but some don't. And a lot of them just think, oh, well, it's not really that important, so what if I just stop it, or maybe I'll stop it, you know, ahead of the time. And I really try to spend time with patients to explain why these treatments are important. And what does come into that is a person's stage and a person's estrogen receptor status. And I try to help patients really visualize what those treatments are doing for them to make sure that we're all okay with the plan of stopping early, so if that's going to be what's going to happen.
So when you are now seeing patients, how is the knowledge of what your patients say they know and don't know or remember and don't remember, how has that changed what you're doing now? Maybe you can think about some recent examples of things you're doing, and are they different?
Yeah, I mean, because I'm so aware of this now, I actually, when I sit down with a patient, and I think this is very variable, every provider has their own style, of course, but what I've started doing is actually writing this stuff down for people. I draw pictures of what cancer cells are. I write receptors on there. I write staging. I'll write the different treatments and checkbox next to them what we're going to do and why. And I spend time doing that, and then I give that paper to patients after our visit. And a lot of them collect my little drawings, and they joke about my drawings. But I hope that they're helpful, and patients can go back to them and refer to them when they're trying to figure out, like, why did you tell me I needed that? Or
Maybe you could share a drawing or two that we could post on our website.
Sure, I'd be happy to.
That'd be great on a napkin.
Yeah, on a napkin. I usually do it on a piece of computer paper. It's very low-key, but I just pull it out, and I take their pathology report, and I go through it with them and explain what the terms mean. And
that's great.
I do think it helps. I mean, it does require repetition because I realize that patients hear so much information, and they're not used to hearing this terminology, but I try really hard to kind of bring it down to a basic level for people.
How about for the families? So, I mean, there are occasionally those dynamics where an individual patient may say, you know, I don't want to know the prognosis. I want to, you know, come up with a treatment plan perhaps or not, but maybe the family wants to know. How do you handle that dynamic? And then in a situation where they're in the same dynamic, how much attention do you give to teaching the family these things?
So, you know, what happens, which is I think unique to cancer, is that patients often come with their families. You know, it's definitely a diagnosis that people, you know, kind of come together for. And so a lot of my patients, especially in the beginning, come with supportive friends or family, and we all encourage that because I think it does help to have multiple ears in the room and multiple supports there. And I think there's lots of dynamics that happen. You just have to do the best you can. I mean, the patient is the boss. So if a family member wants to ask me a question or pull me aside or they call, I always go back to the patient and ask and make sure it's okay to talk to that person, even if they're asking something that the patient doesn't want to know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you really need to engage the patient as much as possible. And obviously there are cultural differences in that. There are sometimes language barriers where the sons and daughters are interpreting for their parent, which is a difficult thing.
Mm-hmm.
And there can be some filtering in what you're saying. And I think, you know, I really try to bring it back to the patient. If the patient says, I don't want to know, but you can talk to them, then I will. If the patient says, actually, I really want to know that and be a part of that conversation, then, of course, that's how we're going to do it. So I think it just you have to kind of go with it and try to adapt to whatever your patients need. And throughout the day, it's just swinging back and forth between different styles depending on, you know, the patient you're seeing and what the story is.
So let me ask you a question. You know, we are now in a time in which we're thinking about patient-centered outcomes in medicine, outcomes that matter to patients. How would it look if instead of we were talking about talking to patients about cancer, we talked about listening to patients with cancer? And I'm thinking about this particularly from a primary care physician's viewpoint because I'm not necessarily directing the cancer treatments. What recommendations do you have for providers about listening to patients with cancer?
Oh, I think it's huge. I think we need to do much better at this. We need to listen to patients with what their needs are. You know, there are a lot of questions we don't ask. You know,
like,
you got to check in on how they're doing emotionally. Are they sleeping? Are they eating? Are they sexually active? Are they doing okay financially? We know that patients have so much strain in their lives, and those are questions we really don't ask about very much. We're bad at that. We're busy, and I think that sometimes it's hard to kind of stop and step back and really listen to what the patient needs and what they're going through. But you're absolutely right, Adam. I totally agree. We need to be listening as much as we can to our patients throughout, you know, all of the treatment that we give them.
And as we're closing, if you turn that to the patient, to our listeners, what advice do you have for people, whether they themselves or their family members have a diagnosis of cancer, of how to approach those visits to be sure they're getting their questions answered and they are being listened to?
Well, I usually tell patients to bring somebody with them, whether it's a family member or a close friend. And if they don't have that, you know, we have supports that can come in. We have social workers. There's patient navigators who are available in different sites. So I think having that additional person in there with you just to help process the information, write things down, and understand it is so important. People just get so overwhelmed in those initial visits. So I think that's a really great thing to do. I think going to reputable websites, if you're somebody who likes to get online, is a good thing. And just try to sort of read the basics and understand. And a lot of sites like the American Cancer Society and Susan G. Komen have lists of questions that you can print out for breast cancer. And every cancer has its specific questions, and that can help guide conversations as well. I have people come in with those checklists. And then, you know, I think just making sure that patients feel comfortable asking questions and coming back to talk mm-hmm. more. I try to say that a lot so that people feel like they can ask you something they don't understand.
Great.
Well, we appreciate being able to ask you things that you really clearly are an expert in your recent research in cancer, and know that your work was cited in the New York Times. We really appreciate you sharing this work and your expertise with your health listeners.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Great chatting with you.
We've been talking with Dr. Rachel Friedman, assistant professor at Harvard Medical School and medical oncologist at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, about talking to patients about cancer. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the house call segment of our show today, Adam and I will spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and your concerns.
If you have a question or comment you'd like us to address on an upcoming show, send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And Christy, we have some really interesting house calls today about a college student who's stressed.
About an unusual burning sensation in someone's fingers.
About someone from Idaho that wants to share something that we like to hear.
And someone who's challenged to decide whether to go to the doctor or not about something due to cost.
So Erica Nori, our executive producer, will read us our very first house call.
I'm an 18-year-old college student who currently suffers from lots of stress and a constant tight pain in my head. I went to an on-campus doctor who said it could be the stress of school along with my lack of sleep. I feel pretty down, but can't pinpoint why I feel the way I do. I exercise and try to monitor my diet. I'd really like to hear your thoughts.
Oh, well, thank you for sharing that with us and writing a question. It's hard to do when you're feeling down and vulnerable. You know, what your campus doctor said makes a lot of sense. If you are feeling stressed and you're not sleeping, that can, you know, lead to headaches and stressful feelings and feeling down. But it also, I have lots of other questions for you to know if there's an element of depression here or loneliness as you're in college, and if there are other substances involved or what else is going on in your life.
You know, sometimes we think of depression as a psychological diagnosis and thyroid diseases and other things like that as a medical diagnosis. But the reality is depression has biologic chemistry, things that happen. And so we have a diagnosis that's somewhere between depression and not depression. That's called dysthymia. Sometimes people call it minor depression. And you just don't feel good.
Yeah. And I would encourage you, and I don't know if you have a relationship with this on-campus doctor, but this is the kind of thing that you really want to see somebody that you can follow up with that person and have deeper conversations that explore both medical illnesses, like you mentioned thyroid, Adam, but also really to get to know you and what else is going on and try to help you work through it.
One thing that could be helpful is just some simple massage therapy, because if you've got some pain in your head, chances are really good that you've got maybe some tight muscles in the back. So some really just simple things like massage can't hurt.
Yeah, thank you for your question, and we wish you all the best as you're working to feel better.
Erica, what's our very next house call?
I woke up one morning with a burning sensation in my fingers, only in my left hand. The sensation never reached the palm of my hand, and it didn't seem to impact my hand function. I didn't see any type of bite, cut, or scratch, and I did not handle any spicy food or apply lotion the night before. It was really uncomfortable. My only relief was placing my hand in cold water. This sensation lasted for about 4 hours and went away. What was this?
Well, I can say with absolute certainty, Christy, that I'm not certain.
I can say I don't know.
I would call this a periarticular, perifinger neuropathy, neuropathic. It was some type of pain in the finger. How about that? Idiopathic pain in the finger.
Right. And burning sensation usually is sort of a nerve type of pain. I would wonder, it sounds like you already explored, did you have a bite or did you handle spicy food or all that kind of thing? I would wonder if maybe you touched something that you don't realize. There are things, if this was going to come and go a lot, there are medical conditions that could cause that with vitamin deficiencies or other things, thyroid, other things that can sound scary. But if it just happened one time and it goes away and doesn't come back, then we probably will have to be okay with not knowing.
Yeah, that's kind of what I sometimes say, Christine. I know maybe it's not so satisfactory, but I sometimes say, you know, I don't know. And I look up to the skies and I hope that someone does know up there. But certainly if you woke up with it, sometimes people's hands are curled in funny ways. If you ever took videos of the way our hands are when we sleep sometimes, and it could cut off a little circulation. And, you know, that could cause some numbness. I'm so glad it's better.
Yes, me too. And sorry we don't have a great answer for it, but we hope that it doesn't come back. All right, let's take our very next house call, Erica.
I just have to write and say that I love the way you two relay medical information to your listeners. You two really make us feel comfortable about reaching out to your show, and that's not always common. My wife and I could listen to your show all day. We are so glad you've become part of our community. Thanks again, a loyal listener from Idaho.
Well, that's really so kind, though. I think now I feel bad, Christy, because we just said we had no idea. And now you're not going to listen to that all day.
I know. But hopefully it's refreshing to hear doctors not be too proud to admit that sometimes we don't have all the answers. Many times we don't have all the answers. But we're glad you're enjoying listening to the show. And it's just sweet encouragement to hear that that is something beneficial to you and your wife. Thank you.
I mean, one of the things that Christy and I really like is the fact that we get to and feel, you know, humbled that we get to see patients and we hear the stories each day. And so this challenge and this dialogue that we're able to have is really, you know, a privilege for us.
It is.
And so we want to thank our listeners in Idaho and Wilmington and the Triangle across North Carolina and really all the different states where people tune in. Please do send us your comments, questions, and thank you so much for that very nice comment.
Mm-hmm. Erica, what's our last house call question?
I'm a 34-year-old male who has experienced blurry vision and dizziness over the last week or so. I literally just started my new job, and my insurance coverage doesn't begin for another week. Can I wait until I'm insured to see a doctor, or do you think it's in my best interest to go see someone now? My wife is really concerned, and I would like to go to the doctor to put her mind at ease, but we're on a really strict budget right now. I would appreciate your thoughts.
This is a really difficult, and I'm not certain that our answers are going to be totally satisfactory, because at the one level, Christy and I will want to know that, you know, you're safe. And safety, for a lot of times in a doctor's, will be this 100% confidence that nothing bad's going to happen. And we can't say that. But on the other hand, we know that your concerns are about being safe, but also being financially affordable. And that's the conversation I would encourage you to have maybe with a doctor right up front, because if I was your doctor, I would say, I'll work with you on that one.
Yeah. And I mean, you are young and you started a new job. Lots of reasons that might be, you know, stress related for having feeling dizzy or blurry vision or other things, but it also could be something more serious. Another idea, if your doctor won't work with you, is to think about going to a community health center or to a health department or somewhere where you can have a sliding scale fee where maybe it wouldn't be as expensive considering you don't have insurance.
Yeah, I think one of the things that we would both try to avoid is avoiding the emergency room. The emergency room, you really do lose lots of control, and perhaps a quick visit to your doctor to say, I just want to be reassured that we're okay right now, and maybe I'll put off some other testing to a little bit later, and they can check your blood pressure if they maybe need to check blood sugar if they need to, some things that are inexpensive and easy.
Right. I would agree with that as well. Thank you for sharing your house calls, and thanks to all of you who've written questions and comments for us today. We hope we've answered some questions and concerns that are important to your health. We want you to share your questions, share your stories. Email us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org, on Twitter, on Facebook. Get our health app by searching Your Health, one word, for a free download at the App Store.
We'd like to thank the University of North Carolina Department of Family Medicine, University of North Carolina Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our great guest today, Dr. Rachel Friedman. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.